The Secrets of Star Trek is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to The Secrets of Star Trek, where we discuss the hidden layers and deeper meanings found in all the Star Trek TV series, movies, and more. And today we're discussing the Voyager episode, Revulsion. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today on the panel are Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
Howdy, and for English speakers, the title of today's episode is Revulsion.
I wanted to say it like that the actor in it says it, you know, the Revulsion. Yeah. And Father Corey Stika. Hey, Father Corey.
How's it going?
Good, good. And so, folks, be sure to stick around to the end of the show. We have more of your great listener feedback. Be sure to share the podcast with your friends. Help us grow this community of Star Trek fans and to reach even more listeners. And I want to tell you about another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy called The Secrets of Star Wars, which you can find wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/StarWars. So we are discussing this fourth season Voyager episode, the fifth episode of the fourth season. And Jimmy, can you give us a recap of what happens?
This week, Voyager gets a distress call from an alien hologram. The hologram says there's been an accident on its ship, the whole crew is dead, and it's alone. Janeway sends the Doctor and B'Elanna in a shuttle to help the hologram while they do other stuff. This leads to our time-filling B-plot, in which Harry Kim is assigned to help Seven of Nine do some science-y stuff, and he becomes infatuated with her, which leads to a lot of awkwardness played for laughs that goes nowhere. Meanwhile, B'Elanna and the Doctor discover that the alien hologram is childlike, emotionally fragile, psychotic, and homicidal. The accident that happened on its ship actually involved it killing all six of the organic members of its crew. It invites the Doctor to steal the ship it's on and come with it to explore the galaxy, and it becomes hysterical when he wants to go back to Voyager. Eventually, it attacks B'Elanna and the Doctor. It takes the Doctor offline by striking his mobile emitter, which it steals, and it severely wounds B'Elanna, but she finally shorts it out with an electrical cable, so all is well with the world again. The end.
Father Corey, your impression of this one?
This is one of these episodes where it's got one decent plot and one very cringy plot. The plot with the hologram, the isomorphic projection. This was very much a development episode for the Doctor. At least that plot was very much to develop the Doctor's character, to show what could happen, the risk for the Doctor that if his program goes awry and so on. So I mean, it was, that part was decent. That was a decent plot. The Harry Kim in Seven of Nine was cringy. It was eye candy for men. I mean, it would have been so much better episode if that was just not the B plot.
Mm. How about you, Jimmy?
I thought overall the episode was okay. I focused on the hologram plot and it was okay. The actor, he's a guy named Leland Orser who was playing the alien hologram. He was good. He did a good job of being childlike, fragile, and psychotic. Mm-hmm. And he's a genuinely scary guy. I could, find fault with his performance on a few things, but overall, I thought that plot was good. I thought the Harry Kim thing was totally superfluous.
Yeah.
It's also meant to develop Seven, because Seven, this is like only her third episode as a member of the crew.
Yeah.
You know, she was kind of introduced, but wasn't really a crew member in the season opener two-parter. But this is like the fifth episode of the season, so she's been a crew member now for three episodes. This is early days for her, and so this is meant to develop her character as well.
Yeah. Apparently, Leland Orser, the guest actor, was heading out to film Saving Private Ryan. Mm-hmm. So they only had 4 days to film all of his scenes before he had to go. I liked the main plot as well. I guess I'm in agreement with both of you that it was pretty good. The director was Ken Biller, who is normally a writer. It was his first directing credit on Voyager, and I think he did a pretty creditable job. He apparently was inspired a lot by the movie Psycho, especially like he almost like exact framing of the shot for some of them from right out of the movie Psycho.
Yeah, like there's a scene where the hologram is bringing a plate of food to B'Elanna that is reminiscent of the scene in Psycho where Norman Bates brings sandwiches to Marion. And they have a kind of a little bit of an uncomfortable exchange. But Psycho isn't Psycho without the shower scene.
That's true. That's true.
Or the twist at the end.
Yes.
And this doesn't have either one of those.
That's true. That's true. It was a surprisingly gruesome first shot where we see Leland sort of cleaning up after the crime. And we see him pull one of the dead crew members off of a bench. And it leaves a smear of bright red blood down the wall and across the floor. And that was fairly graphic for, you know, Voyager at the time, you know, for TV. It wasn't network TV, but it was cable syndication.
That's another thing where this differs from Psycho, because in Psycho, you don't know what Norman Bates is in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I mean, the movie is set up to make you think that Marion is the psycho, because we start focusing on this character, Marion. She's like the first act of the film is all about her. She's working in an office job. She's having an affair with the guy on the side. A bunch of money comes into her office and she steals the money and goes on the lam. And, you know, the whole first act of Psycho is about her. Norman is not even in it. And Hitchcock is painting this portrait of Marion as a psycho because of what she's doing in her life. And eventually she stops at the Bates Motel and she starts talking to Norman and she starts realizing she's made a mistake and she knows something creepy's going on with Norman's mother. And then apparently out of the blue, Norman's mother kills her in the shower. And so there's multiple layers before we find out what's really going on at the Bates Motel, which I'm deliberately not alluding to directly. And there's nothing like that here. With the opening, with seeing the hologram cleaning up, or isomorph as they call it, which actually is a better name than hologram.
Right.
Isos in Greek means equal, and morphe means form. So yeah, he's got an equal form to a human, or whatever his species is. Hologram means whole writing, and isomorph actually makes better sense. But we see him cleaning up from a murder, and it's like we know this thing is messed up from the beginning. There would be more tension in this. It would be more like Psycho if they didn't have that opening. And the first thing we learn about this is, help, I'm desperate. There's been an accident. My crew is dead. And not even necessarily know that it's a hologram. And they could still send the doctor, not because it's a hologram, but because they may need medical attention. And then you can find out it's a hologram.
I mean, I could see going either way. You've often seen them do that in various other stories. But in this one where the audience knows information the characters don't from the beginning. And, you know, it creates a different kind of tension. Like, when are they going to figure it out? When are they going to figure it out? Mm-hmm. So I think I could go either way with that on that story.
Yeah. It's just a different way of telling the same story, but I think it worked fine for tension as well. Cause you know, the scenes where we know that this guy is going completely off the rails, and B'Elanna's like, well, he just kind of ranted at me for a while. It's like, no, he did more than rant at you. He was ready to kill you right there.
Yeah.
Also, if you're trying to do Psycho, don't pair it with a comedy.
No. Because you undermine the tension. He apparently went crazy, partially, the isomorph did, because it had been confined to the antimatter storage room his whole existence. Like, that's his job was to clean the antimatter storage room and to get rid of the waste. And I'm thinking, like, just, I was trying to, you know, kind of go beyond the story itself and think, why would you need a holographic humanoid to do that job? Why not a robot or an amorphous set of force fields and tractor beams? Why do you need a something that has the form of an intelligent person with a whole personality as well? It just seemed kind of an odd thing. You know, it's not that it's implausible that a culture would do this. Maybe there's some sort of cultural norm that would require that any creature you make, a golem of some sort, has to have to be human as much as possible or something. I don't know. What'd you think of that?
Well, it's plausible depending on what the development of these isomorphs really were in the past. You know, we could think of, you know, maybe there are certain regulations to, for what they can be used for and can't, you know, how intelligent they can make them, you know, with the discussion we have about, around AI, you know, what are the limits of those, that development that we're going to have in our culture? Maybe that's something that, you know, they don't talk about any of this background. We just know that this guy was programmed right. for one purpose. You know, feed in fuel, get rid of waste, basically.
Yeah, but there is, I assume this was some kind of off-the-shelf technology for them that they were applying in a bunch of circumstances because it could do the jobs, even if it wasn't designed for them. The problem is that they gave it more capacity than was required for the jobs, and that created a conflict with the environments it was being put into, to where it started to resent being kept in a closet. And that's what you don't want to program your AIs to do. So it was a bad fit between the technology they were applying and the purpose to which they were applying it, and it went crazy and killed everybody, as you do.
And of course, you've got the parallel between the doctor being stuck in sick bay, which is much bigger than obviously this space, but still he was stuck in one room, one part of the ship that he couldn't get to anywhere else, and this isomorph. But of course, the doctor then gets the mobile emitter and has free reign of the ship at that point.
And he also, this is a kind of a path not taken story. It shows what could have happened with the doctor in some dark scenario that the writers would never allow to actually play out. But the doctor had to be assertive and demand, you know, more respect from the crew, which is true. Although actually in the list of examples he gives, his memory is flawed, which is a sign of problems coming down the line, because he's misremembering that Janeway volunteered some of the privileges he's naming to him as things he had to ask for.
Because the doctor sort of, you know, sympathizes at first and then encourages the Djarin to think about, trust that the doctor had to gain to get his.
It's even more than sympathy, and this is one of the flaws in the writing in Voyager that I really don't like. He's identifying so much with the hologram that he's
blinded.
He's blind and to what's going on with the hologram in ways he shouldn't be. And that helps set up the drama by making him reluctant. So you get a little bit of a clash between him and B'Elanna about how much leeway should we show this guy? Is he really crazy? You got to understand his background and stuff like that. But the doctor's just blind and it's obvious to the viewer, the doctor is blind to what's really going on with this guy in ways that he shouldn't be. Right. And that, I think, is a writing flaw.
Well, right from the start, where on the bridge, as soon as they get this communication, the doctor's like, you know, send a message. I'm going to go over. And the captain's like, as far as I remember, I'm still the captain of this ship.
Yeah.
You know, he really oversteps, which is interesting.
Well, I guess I don't see that as a writing flaw. I see that showing the enthusiasm. I mean, that the doctor, you know, this is a situation the doctor hasn't experienced yet. Mm. And he's so excited that this is another potentially sentient hologram that he could interact with. You know, it'd be another person of his species. So I don't see it as a writing flaw. Maybe it wasn't written well, but I don't see it as a writing flaw in any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
I just see it as again, you know, he
I think it was intentional.
The doctor is kind of like a child himself. I mean, he's only technically 4 years old at this point.
Right. Yeah. I saw it as an intentional thing that they wanted him to be blinded by his bias in favor of the hologram.
And that's, I think, actually a sign that Starfleet's programming of him is defective.
Oh, yeah.
Because as the emergency medical officer for this ship, taking care of this ship should be his dominant priority.
Right.
And it's like, and so he shouldn't be so oversteppy.
Well,
he should be more concerned about, because what Janeway points out to him is, look, I don't want to risk losing you over there because, you know, my concern is the medical welfare of this ship. And Janeway is having to explain to the device whose function it is to care for the medical welfare of the ship that that needs to be his priority.
They kind of lean into this later on when they have him meet his creator on Jupiter Station and see how flawed he was. And in fact, the fact that he was putting his own personality imprint into his holograms, I think you're right. It does show that the Starfleet's oversight of this program was indeed flawed. It shouldn't have been the way it was, and the Doctor should maybe have been less independent, ironically. We would not have been the Doctor we came to, for some of us, know and love, because he would have been much more constrained into the role that he should have been.
I think they could still rationalize it. I mean, all Janeway has to do is give him an order, go over there, that guy may need medical help, and they could still make it work. Maybe Starfleet, although I think this may be giving the writers a little much credit, but maybe Starfleet, at least it's plausible to me, you could say maybe Starfleet learned from this experience, because the emergency command hologram program of Janeway acts much more responsibly in Voyager, in Prodigy,
right,
than the Doctor does here in Voyager.
That's true, right? They probably learned a lot from the Doctor being online for 7 years and going through this evolution. We alluded to the scene where D'Jarin first starts to unwind in front of B'Elanna, and I like this scene. It was pretty effective because, this is where we get the title Revulsion. You know, he finds organics disgusting. You know, the way he describes people, he says, I exist as pure energy, but you depend on food and water to survive. Frankly, I find it disgusting. Look at you grinding up bits of plants and animals with your teeth, secreting saliva to force it down your esophagus into a pit of digestive acids. You can't even stand to think of it yourself. What a repulsive creature you are, constantly shedding your skin and hair, leaving your oily sweat on everything you touch. I'm like, by this point, I'm like, yeah, we are pretty gross. You.
Yeah. We're gross, but you know what? The food part is pretty pleasurable. So
it is.
Yeah. He also says he's ashamed to be made in our image.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I have in my notes, good casting, because I think Leland Orser was really good for this part.
He's played characters like this before in the past, where very kind of psychotic or just off. You know, he's really good at playing this kind of character. He's done other kind of characters, but this is one that he does really, really well.
They also changed his skin color, and it's kind of like Data's to indicate he's artificial, but he's not physically artificial, but he's artificial. But he's more pallid than Data is. You know, Data's more golden. This guy's a little more silver. And that pallid, not human skin tone also helps make him creepy.
Yep.
Yes. The design, like the alien ship, is very much lots of shadows, very monocolor, black and white. Yep. In fact, maybe his pallid color and the monochrome set is meant to also invoke the idea of the old black and white thrillers, like psychological thrillers, too. I don't know. I wonder. I didn't see anything about that, but that makes
or just everything on Voyager got dark.
It was clear from the start. Like, they do make it early on, even after the scene where he's cleaning up the bodies, when B'Elanna and the Doctor first show up, and they haven't met him yet, and he appears behind them silently. And he picks up a hammer and he starts approaching, and then the Doctor, I forget what exactly the Doctor says, and he makes him immediately stop, disappear. The hammer falls out of nowhere, which is super creepy. And then he appears in front of them. Hey, I'm here. And that's it's very effectively creepy he's almost like a ghost. And maybe that's another aspect of his skin tone that they've given him is he's like a ghost as well, a malevolent ghost. It's kind of interesting.
By the way, we should mention there are a few extra little subplots in this episode that we haven't even touched on. One of them is we open with Tuvok getting a promotion from lieutenant to lieutenant commander, which I guess this is an interesting situation because in a real military people would move up over the course of 7 years and move off to other assignments mm-hmm. in a way they don't here because they're stuck in the Delta Quadrant. And that would pose Janeway with interesting challenges regarding promotions because you can inflate people's ranks, but they're still going to be doing the same jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tuvok gets a promotion, even though he's still just the security chief. And
Harry isn't.
And Harry isn't. And if you're gonna have to, so Janeway would be in this interesting position where she's got to figure out when to use promotions. Mm-hmm. Because she can't just promote everybody all at once and make them all, you know, commanders. So she needs to ration who she gives promotions to because it's one of the few rewards she's got to give people career-wise. And of all people, Tuvok would understand why he doesn't need to get a promotion. You know, he doesn't have that human ego to bruise or stroke. Which is essentially all promotions are in this case.
I would say that a couple things on that.
Yeah.
One is the promotion may not be just for Tuvok, but for the rest of the crew, sort of designate Tuvok is third in command of the ship. And so he ranks higher than the chief engineer and that sort of thing. So I can see that one do that. And I'm not sure if it's in today's Navy it's the same way, but even in the past, especially like in the Age of Sail, when the ships would go far out of range of the Admiralty, you know, the British Admiralty, the captain generally had a lot of leeway over his crew's promotion to a degree. And each of the roles had a variety of or a range of ranks that could be in it. So you could be a midshipman in charge of a gun division, but you could also be a lieutenant, you know. And so there was that opportunity that they could move up within that, and there'd be a range in there. And I could see her doing some of that, but it is glaring, and I think all Trek fans have noticed how glaring it is that Harry just gets stuck. And it's not like he's incompetent. She relies on him for every, you know, just as much as any of the other senior staff. So why is Harry stuck? I've never seen an adequate explanation of that.
Part of it may be off screen because Garrett Wang, who plays Harry Kim, even though he's very personable in the role, had a reputation on set for not being the most professional actor. He like wouldn't know his lines and stuff like that. And like one of the things that that they did in the Star Trek production house to reward actors who were doing a good job is if the actor wanted to direct and could show they're being a professional actor, they show up on time, they know their lines, and they do all the study needed to become a director, then they'll let him direct.
Mm-hmm.
Garrett Wong, no.
Yeah.
Because he apparently had a reputation, I don't know, for missing his call times or for not knowing his lines, but he was regarded as not being professional enough. And consequently, he never got a chance to direct. Although I believe, at least that's the vibe I get.
Mm-hmm.
Another subplot that happens in this, since Cass is now gone, we need a new nurse in sick bay. And so the doctor recruits Tom Paris for that role. And B'Elanna had apparently just shortly before this confessed her love for Tom in an emergency circumstance.
Two episodes ago. Yeah.
Yeah. And so now, he and B'Elanna are dealing briefly with that, the aftermath of that confession at the beginning. And Tom broaches the subject with her and she's like, oh yeah. He's like, I know you probably didn't mean it. And she's like, oh no, I meant it, but I don't expect you to reciprocate. So let's just pretend I never said it. And he just kisses her. Which is exactly the right thing he needed to do at that point. That was good writing. I like that.
Yeah. The Tom B'Elanna relationship in the back half of the series was pretty good. I was pretty happy with. I mean, they had its ups and downs in the writing, but I'm glad they did it. That made sense.
One thing I want to go back because I didn't get a chance to address it was with the military ranks. You know, Dom, you asked if like the Navy could promote, you know, that the commander has leeway in promoting. And I can say for the Air Force that there is some. I mean, as you said, a lot of positions have rank specific. You know, if you're going to be in this position, you must be a one-star general. If you're going to be in this position. And there are also some, like chaplain, for example, where you've got these ranges of, you know, like first lieutenant to major, where you're just, you're a chaplain. But then there's some leeway in that as well. Like you said, where if someone is performing extremely well, the commander can absolutely put in for this person to get a promotion like that. Now, of course, today we're very rarely in the situation where any military is not in contact with their superiors at some point, you know, with satellite communication, even, you know, even the carrier that's out in deepest, darkest Pacific Ocean can still get a hold of an admiral fairly easily. You know, so that's a very rare circumstance. But you hear battlefield promotions, for example, that is still a thing. That's still very much a thing. We don't have a lot of that today, but that could very much happen, you know, in necessity. So it's for this Tuvok. And I do think it's likely, like you said, Dom, that she is saying he's our second. He's our number two. Chakotay is number one.
Yeah.
He's number two. So that, you know, just like Data was, you know, was the number two. He was the third in command on the Enterprise, you know, same kind of deal. So,
Another sort of plot hole thing. Why does Voyager continue to drop off crew members in shuttlecraft? Because every time they do it, last episode, this episode, three episodes ago in Day of Honor, it goes wrong every single time.
Well, this was irritating because they had this. The whole idea was that Voyager was going to meet with this ambassador of an alien race. And so they just say, okay, B'Elanna and Doctor, you guys just take off in the shuttlecraft and we're going to go this way instead. That was only so Neelix could get his, you know, Ethan Phillips could get his, you know, 5 minutes on screen so he could get paid for this episode, basically. But it was just, so instead of saying, hey, well, you know, we'll go meet with the ambassador, you know, after we take care of this issue.
Off our only doctor.
It's because of the constraint of episodic writing, where we just need to have things go wrong and we need to not be able to solve them immediately. And that means getting the main ship and all of its resources out of the way so that the characters we are focusing on will have very limited resources to use at their disposal.
And when they were supposedly meeting with this ambassador, we don't see him.
I know, we don't even see that. So it's clearly just to get Voyager out of the way so that the Doctor and B'Elanna can be in this small situation where they're threatened and can't just beam away. Also, they don't even have all the resources they should have. B'Elanna has to, in her final conflict. Now, I wanted to say I like what the hologram does to her, because when it's fighting her, it reaches, I mean, it can turn insubstantial at will, and it can turn different parts of its body substantial or insubstantial. So it reaches into her chest and grabs her heart and starts squeezing. And the doctor later tells us it punctured her fourth ventricle, which is interesting because humans only have two ventricles. We have two atria and two ventricles. But she's got four. And then eventually she takes it out by ripping a cable out of the wall that's an electrical cable and waving it through the hologram.
Check us conduit.
So she disrupts its electrical field, which should only work temporarily, but does permanently for some reason. What she ought to do is whip out her phaser, because you're going into another environment. You should have a sidearm, and a phaser ought to disrupt a hologram. You know, they're both phased energy light construct things, so she ought to be able to just phaser it.
They did say early on, because there's a point where
they introduced.
By the way, we never did say his name. His name's Djarin. He's bringing the food to B'Elanna, and there's a cable there, you know, fancies, you know, future cable sitting there, and he's about to step close to it, and she said that if he had contacted with it, it would have disrupted his matrix. In other words, it would have
stabilized
his program.
And
basically, this is some kind of hollow ISO whatever power conduit, where it's not a typical power conduit, but it has something to do with the holographic system. That if he got in contact with it. So it's Chekhov's cable is basically what it was, you know, that this is how it was going to end up killing him. And it was, so it wasn't just a typical power con. It wasn't, you know, 220 volt power con or something like that.
It also goes back to the big problem, the way that they envision the hologram technology throughout Voyager and throughout Star Trek, which is that holoprograms are weirdly self-contained. So the Doctor doesn't make a copy of himself and send it into the mobile emitter and still exist on the ship, mm-hmm. which he should be able to do. No, no, he downloads his program and erases it from the Enterprise, yeah. the Voyager's computer. And it's like, and if you destabilize the Djarin right in front of you, you know, it's not, his program won't reload from the computer. It's gone. It's just like, it's just,
this has
that's
been
a problem.
There's been a common complaint with how Star Trek handles data. I mean, just the idea of, you know, they have pads. Okay. But that's the only way you pass the data. You don't, it's not like, you know, what we can do today is, oh, let me
email you the file.
Drop that to you. Let me, you know, put this on Dropbox and you can get a copy of it. Oh no, it's, I have to give you this physical iPad so that you can then read whatever I need to give you.
They don't have a cloud on board any Starfleet vessels.
At least Battlestar Galactica, you know, did it right where they just said all our computers are disconnected.
Because
we have to literally make Cylons. A copy and take it to somewhere else.
Because of Cylons. So, just to finish up with Djarin and the Doctor, like it's not till Djarin assumes that the Doctor is a prisoner on Voyager that the Doctor realizes that Djarin is cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs and realizes. So that's the final straw for the Doctor. All right, let's deal with the Harry Kim in the room. And just quickly, Harry Kim is like Geordi LaForge. Mm-hmm. Like we just talked about the Geordi being made into the bad with women character on his show.
Only Geordi was popular enough he could make a condition of his comeback show, I've been successful with women.
Exactly. I don't think if Harry Kim ever came back, he would ever get that opportunity. So, even to having a hologram romance once, like Harry had been, you know, matched up with a hologram, like it's weird repetition. I'm not sure why they did this.
They were desperate to find scripts to use.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's part of the unfortunate sexualization of Jeri Ryan's character here, you know, where in this early stage, we need to bring in the sexy, Borg and, you know, have her in her cat suit and do all this stuff. And so they were early. I'm glad they kind of move away from this a little bit, not far enough in my opinion, I guess. But Harry falls for her, cause Harry falls for everybody. And even Paris puts a pin in it. You know, you're always going for the tough ones, Harry. You're always, you know, and then we have this whole awkward scene. I mean, it would have been fine up to this point, but that awkward scene in the mess hall where Harry is hinting that they should go to a holoprogram on a beach again, you know, the repetition. And she bluntly says, oh, you want to do this and that and engage in reproductive behavior. And you know, she's a Borg. She doesn't understand subtlety. And she's like, sure, whatever, let's go. And it's like, and then Harry backs down because it's too forward for him or whatever.
Now this scene was one that they apparently used with auditions for the 7 of 9 role to see how the actresses would perform. And, you know, Jeri Ryan won the part. And I assume deservedly so, because she's good in the role.
Right.
But it's not the only scene that they used for auditions, but it was one of them. And Jeri Ryan didn't like this scene and said she might not have taken the part if they hadn't shown her other scenes as well. So she kind of tolerated doing this scene. I think I find it embarrassing for Harry. Mm-hmm. I find it less embarrassing for Seven as a character, given where she's coming from. She's been part of this collective, and she has not, the Borg apparently don't reproduce the way we do, although they kind of, they probably use sperm banks or something, who knows.
Right.
But, because we have seen a Borg baby before, right. You know. Although here she doesn't mention that, she just mentions assimilating other races, but that's not really how you build a population. You need something beyond just assimilating, keep your population numbers up. But in any event, she's not been, for her entire adult life, has not thought in male-female reproductive terms. But she's picking up on when Harry suggests that they go to this, he'll show her this holodeck simulation. She says, oh, you are attempting to create a romantic environment. And that's exactly what he's trying to do, but mm-hmm. it's not handled in the subtle way that humans would do that. And so he's like, oh, no, 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 no. Oh, then you wish to copulate. And whoa, and that's way too forward for him. As he's flummoxed for a minute, she's like, well, I haven't been thinking in these terms, but now that I'm becoming human again, I'm open to exploring different aspects of my humanity. And actually, that makes sense mm-hmm. for her as a character. And so I don't mind the way Seven is written in this. It's incredibly cringy for mm-hmm. Harry.
Yeah.
But for Seven, coming from the background that she has as a character, this actually would make sense for her, and she wouldn't have the cultural understanding of marriage and reproduction mm-hmm. and the weight of all of these things that mm-hmm. real humans have, because we grew up in a human culture and she didn't. She just knows mm-hmm. this is part of humanity, and I need to explore humanity since I'm becoming a human again, so I should explore this.
Yeah,
but not in this way.
Well, that is the one thing I do like about this particular plot line, is it is a plot line of her trying to figure out what it means to be human, because it starts mm-hmm. with her getting injured when they pull a piece of, you know, navigational technology or whatever out of a Borg equipment, and she gets injured. She gets cut on the hand, like very seriously cut on the hand. It wasn't just a little flesh wound. It was deep. And she's trying to, you know, oh, well, if I were Borg, I would have already been healed. The nanobots would have already healed me. You know, so that part of it was mm-hmm. was good, but the whole thing was kind of cringy. I mean, it was comical where her reaction, though, was like, oh, you want to copulate? Let's go.
Right. You know, it is interesting to contrast this with Djarin, because, you know, he finds revulsion at the gross human biological organic things, whereas, you know, Seven is coming from a Borg perfection, machine perfection environment too. Mm-hmm. And for her, she's not experiencing that revulsion, which she might, like a couple episodes, she probably would have. But now, mm-hmm. as she's become more human, she's actually more interested in that human connection, you know, the human aspects of these relationships. She doesn't understand it. She doesn't have the moral or cultural underpinnings, like you mentioned, Jimmy, you know, but it's she's not revolted by it. And I think that's an interesting contrast inside this story. And so maybe this story, this B plot is not, in retrospect, maybe not, it's not quite so bolted on as it might have seemed at first.
Well, maybe, but it's also, I think it's mismatched because it's comedic in tone.
Yeah.
Not mm-hmm. in the way, now you can use comedy in horror films. They help break the tension. But this is not that.
No.
This is cringy.
And you could have done it dramatic, like, you know, without all the comedy. You could have had, you know, light humor, but yeah. made it a more dramatic, romantic thing.
So, yeah. Also, why are her nanobots not healing her now? That doesn't make sense to me. Mm. I mean, they make a big deal out of her nanobots. But maybe if they would have
deactivated that feature of the nanobots? I don't know.
Why would you want to deactivate that, though?
I think they're still, the writers are still figuring out exactly the parameters yeah. of her, what she's, how Borg she still is. And yeah. in fact, I think Jerry Ryan had said she felt like they gave her too much of a sense of humor in this episode. It's yes. too early.
And they backed mm-hmm. off on that. So she yeah. didn't, she kind of cracks a joke with Harry.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they back off on that. She doesn't crack any more jokes for a while.
Right. So in the end, there was an amusing scene where Harry's trying to get out of working with Seven now because he feels awkward. He should feel awkward.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Chakotay keeps saying, no, no, I think you guys work great together. No, no. You know, is there any reason why you shouldn't be in? Oh, no, no, we get along. I mean, and as he leaves with Chakotay having basically said, you are going to do your job and you're going to do it.
And oh, by the way, this is an order.
Yeah. Chakotay smirks. He knew exactly what he was doing to Harry here. He knew what was going on, and he was teasing Harry about him and Seven working together. I thought that was kind of a funny little subtle moment, maybe Beltran throwing in the smirk as a sort of added mm-hmm. layer. But
he told Harry, he's like, well, I talked with Seven about this, and she says that you're a reasonably efficient worker and all these things. And he's like, wait, you talked to her?
Yeah, he totally undercuts Harry in this. This is very cringy for Harry, which is where the humor is supposed to derive from, and that Harry is trying to bluff his way without revealing that he put the moves on Seven. He's trying to get out of having to work with her. And he says, you know, we had a misunderstanding. And he's trying to make, oh, it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal, but we had a misunderstanding. It'd be better if she took the lead on this and I bowed out of this project. Mm-hmm. And because we had this minor misunderstanding, and Chakotay just cuts him off at the knees and says, well, that's not what she said. It's like suddenly Harry realizes he's been talking to Seven. It's like, she said you were reasonably efficient and helped her explore aspects of her humanity. And so that sounds good to me.
You know, if Harry wasn't so immature, he should have just said to Seven in the mess hall, no, I just want to get to know you better. I'm interested in you. You're an interesting person. You've had experiences that no other human being has had. I'd like to become your friend and to know you better. Even if he did have romantic intentions, but Harry is just so immature here. I mean, he's a kid, you know, he's about 22 out of the academy or something. So it's hard to blame him, but a more mature officer might.
He should be a better liar.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, the social lie of dating. Chakotay, in fact, actually shows how to do this much better later on, you know, at the end of the series.
With Seven.
And it's interesting to see how Seven has evolved into the Picard era and what a different person she is from this early on version of Seven and how she's changed a lot. So it's interesting to see that. Any other notes on this episode, Father Corey?
So the end is the doctor back in a sick bay, and he's, you know, upset with Tom Paris because he's made a mess out of sick bay. You know, Tom Paris and now the nurse, and he's made a mess out of sick bay. And he does the little joke of, oh, you know, you organics cause so much trouble. You know, he's acting like he's going.
He's
psycho.
freaking Balana out.
Yeah, freaking Balana out big time. And he goes, just kidding. It should be more organic, and drops it. And of course, there's a line about, I shouldn't be quite so fastidious. And it's like, you're in sick bay. That's the one place on the ship where you want someone to be fastidious, especially with cleansing the, you know, things like viruses and bacteria.
Right. Hypersprays should not be on the floor.
You know, but it was kind of a clever, or not a clever ending, but it was kind of a funny ending, you know, kind of end on a high note, kind of the Voyager version of the TOS, you know,
the clarinet of humor.
Between.
Clarinet of humor. Yes, yeah. That's right. If this were TOS, that would have had the clarinet of humor as he put his feet up on the desk. That's true. All right, Jimmy, how about you? Anything left?
I thought it was interesting. At one point, we get into this situation where after the hologram squeezes B'Elanna's heart and makes her unconscious, it then goes to confront the doctor. And they're basically having a slap fight because both of them can turn insubstantial.
Right. Yeah.
And the doctor at one point looks at Djarin and is like, so what are you going to do now? We can both turn insubstantial to each other. And Djarin, who has but it's something like a pickaxe. He just swings it at the doctor's mobile emitter and causes him to vanish. It's like, okay, there was an asymmetry breaker here.
Yeah,
that's true. Okay, so that is our discussion of Revulsion. Like I said, we had some feedback, and this comes from our discussion of the previous Voyager episode we had on initiations from the second season. The first comment comes from Brian, who is a patron. Thank you, Brian, for your support. And he says, I enjoy the secrets of Star Trek. For the episode Initiations, I heard a podcast where it was discussed that Aaron Eisenberg was cast because he was 26 and they wouldn't have the same union regulations they would have if they'd cast a minor actor. So
that could easily be also Aaron Eisenberg, as Nog, was used to working with latex makeup. Mm-hmm. And so there are various actors who can't really work with latex, including for allergic reasons. And so it's like, okay, he's the right height. He can pass for the right age. He's an adult and he can work with latex. Mm-hmm. Let's use him and just not notice the fact that his voice will make him immediately identifiable.
Yeah. I mean, we've worked with him before. We know he's a known quantity. Yeah.
We've got his social security number.
The latex didn't hide him that bad, that much.
Yeah. He is very distinctive looking, like Max Rodencheck. Mm-hmm. And then we got a YouTube comment from Mark Gillies, who writes, I wasn't paying close attention, but I think I got your summary. Nog is a Ferengi and Chakotay is a genius. Yeah, yep. That pretty much sums it up. Sure.
Sounds good. We'll go with that.
We'll go with that. All right. Thank you both for your feedback. We really appreciate it. And now we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create the Secrets of Star Trek, including Erica P., Jonah M., Jonathan L., Father Paul H., and John W. Their generous tax-deductible donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue the Secrets of Star Trek and all the shows at StarQuest, and you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. We'd also like to thank Victor Lambs, who edited this episode. So, what did you think of Revulsion? You can let us know by commenting on the show at sqpn.com/trek, our Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, send an email to trek@sqpn.com, or visit our Discord community at sqpn.com/Discord. You can comment and watch The Secrets of Star Trek on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/StarQuestMedia. And we'll be back next time when we'll be discussing the Enterprise episode, Desert Crossing. Not Desert Crossing, that would have been so much better, but Desert Crossing. Until then, Father Corey Stika, thank you for joining me in sharing the secrets of Star Trek.
Thank you, Dom.
And Jimmy Akin, thank you as well.
Thank you, and live long and prosper, you disgusting, skin-dropping, oily, organic life form.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to The Secrets of Star Trek on StarQuest. And remember, the last time we worked together, I struck you at the base of your skull and attempted to contact the collective. But these things happen.